The following program originates in the USA, is scorned by the GOP, is called AFU by the FBI, has PhDs soiling their BVDs, the CIA serves it as MREs, it contains no MSG, and has a high content of 411. And now, ladies and gentlemen, Visigoth's Grassy Knoll.
This is the road to Orwell Port. Let's see, 8. And this, we'll begin with chapter 11. That is the last chapter in the book. Orwell knew that Lower Benfield was lost forever, but this did not mean that he had lost hope. In his retreat to the isolation of Jura, he did not renounce his faith in a political system he called democratic socialism. Instead, his faith in a political his retreat and the book that this allowed him to work on were a restatement of his pessimism about the modern age. He believed that centralization on top of collectivization meant that power, being far less divisible than money, tends to accumulate in the hands of fewer people. This, allied with the totalitarian outlook that truth is what the party decrees, corrupts not simply socialism but any political movement. So, this is a pretty heavy-duty paragraph, I believe, the second one, if you'll allow me to. He believed that centralization on top of collectivization meant that power, being far less divisible than money, tends to accumulate in the hands of fewer people. Yeah, no problem there. This, allied with the totalitarian outlook that truth is what the party decrees, corrupts not simply socialism, but any political movement. In 1941, he had written, and this is a quote, "The movement towards collectivism goes on all the time, though it takes varying forms, some hopeful, others horrible." 4 years later, in his review of Cyril Connolly's Unquiet Grave, wherein Connolly gives a resounding no to the claim that man will find fulfillment only through participation in the communal life of an organized group, Orwell writes that Connolly's error is, quote, "in assuming that a collectivist society would destroy human individuality. The ordinary English communist or fellow traveler makes the same assumption. It does not occur to them that the so-called collectivist system, now existing only to try to wipe out the individual, because they are not really collectivists, and certainly not egalitarian, because in fact they are a sham covering a new form of class privilege." End of quote. Similarly, in reviewing two books, one An Attack on Capitalism and the other A Defense of It, Orwell wrote, regarding their common conclusion that each other's policy would end in slavery, that the alarming thing is that they might both be right. Just as every line in Animal Farm was aimed in support of democratic socialism and against totalitarianism, so were they directed in 1984. In showing how the horrible forms of collectivism were not restricted to any particular section of the political spectrum, that madness could come from any direction, left or right, the focus of Orwell's writing after Animal Farm changed from a leftist revolution gained and lost through the corruptibility of power to totalitarianism, left or right, entrenched through the corruptibility of power. There have been those who, after reading The Terrors of Room 101, have advanced the theory, some vehemently, others more civilly, that Orwell lost his socialist faith by the time he'd reached 1984. What they have lost sight of, or do not understand, is one of the basic tenets of any creative writer, and one that Orwell asserted as early as The Road to Wigan Pier, namely that write creatively, even of tragedy, one has to possess the spirit of hope. Even Lawrence Brander, for all his criticism of Orwell, understands this. He notes that the Newspeak appendix to 1984 and the Goldstein quotation that speak of the corruption of a socialist ideal are full of zest and joy, and could only have been written by a man who was reasonably well, in parentheses, though he assumes, without citing any evidence, that these sections must therefore have been written earlier. End of parentheses. Sorry for the laugh, but I always say Newsweek instead of Newspeak, and I don't think I'm far off. Okay. Moving on. Bernard Crick challenges the point that Orwell gave up his socialist belief even further by pointing out, Ian Slater's comments correctly, I believe, that pessimism is not necessarily defeatism, just as sensibly noting how much the description of Ingsoc depends on fascism as well as communism. Finally, those who assert that Orwell lost his socialist faith do not understand that to recognize the dangers that face a system in which one has faith is not necessarily to lose that faith. It is the failure of some critics to recognize this that leads them into the non sequitur that because Orwell's faith in socialism, expressed in the hope he placed in the proles, is weakly rooted, his faith is weakly held. This surely is to confuse pessimism with defeatism. Orwell knew of the power-nourished cancer within the body politic, but he also knew that remissions do occur, no matter how serious the prognosis may be. We may be skeptical of the basis for his hope that the proles would serve as the advance guard of a democratic socialism. Indeed, insofar as we are asked to believe that 85% of the population, the proles, are to be ignored by the party, 1984 leaves us little choice but to be skeptical of Orwell's belief. Nevertheless, we can hardly use this as a rationale for doubting the sincerity with which his belief was held. If one is not convinced of this sincerity by the fact that as late as 1948, Orwell was still actively advocating a socialist United States of Europe, perhaps the following, written to Francis A. Henson of the United Automobiles Worker, of the UAW, rather, a labor union in the United States, he says in parentheses, of course we know, less than 7 months before Orwell's death, will offer the skeptic further proof. So without all the parenthetical clauses, let's just say this again. If one is not convinced of the sincerity by the fact that as late as 1948, Orwell was still actively advocating a socialist United States of Europe, perhaps the following will offer the skeptic further proof. And here's the excerpt. My recent novel is, all caps, not intended as an attack on socialism or on the British Labour Party, of which I am a supporter, but as a show-up of the perversions to which a centralized economy is liable and which have already been partly realized in communism and fascism. I do not believe that the kind of society I describe necessarily will arrive, but I believe, in parentheses, allowing, of course, for the fact that the book is a satire, that's interesting, and a parentheses, that something resembling it could arrive. I believe also that totalitarian ideas have taken root in the minds of intellectuals everywhere, and I have tried to draw these ideas out to their logical consequences. The scene of the book is laid in Britain in order to emphasize that the English-speaking races are not innately better than anyone else, and that totalitarianism, if not fought against, could triumph anywhere. You know, so in a way, if Orwell is speaking or writing truthfully, if he is, if he's not saying what he feels he has to, then this kind of further muddies the water as to what 1984 was meant. We were starting off saying about prophecy, or was it a warning? Can it be both? Does the warning come first, and if the warning's not heeded, does it become prophecy? I don't mean to play a semantical game, but perhaps they are both one and the same. But when he says here, in these parentheses, for the fact that the book is a or allowing, of course, for the fact that the book is a satire. Now, is that hedging the statement? For instance, if one allows for the fact that the book is a satire, not saying it definitely is a satire. So that's a pretty interesting excerpt. And we go on back to the text of the book. In short, the voice of disappointment about socialism is not that of rejection. The voice of gloom is not the voice of doom. The careful distinction in Orwell, makes between warning. Oh, here we go. Oh, look, this is I'm cold reading this. I mean, I've read it before. I've not read it aloud, and I have not read it in quite some time. So I'm happily intrigued by what I come across, just like you have, and I don't mean to distract you, but here we go. Actually, excuse me again, chapter 11 is the first one I read. After doing a light once over, it looked to me that 11 had the greatest stuff of all, and now I'm realizing why. So here we go again. Okay. In short, the voice of disappointment about socialism is not that of rejection. The voice of gloom is not the voice of doom. The careful distinction Orwell makes between warning and prophecy is highly significant, for it is the pervasive contemporary notion that 1984 is meant to be prophecy, in parentheses, contrary to what Orwell himself said, end of parentheses. that nourishes the idea that he had given up not just his faith in socialism, but his will to live. It encourages the belief that his withdrawal to the island of Jura was more a death wish than the retreat of a writer who had plans to write much more and who sought such an old, lonely place because in his heart he preferred the past to the present. Despite the debate about whether 1984 signals the end of Orwell's socialist faith, it is generally agreed that much of the novel's importance is due to the fact that it is the culmination of all the major themes that inhabited Orwell's earlier and lesser-known work. Florey's subjugation by imperialism, Comstock's hatred of capitalism, Dorothy Hare's loss of faith, and Bowling's loss of the past. But if these are old themes from his journalism, essays, and novels, there are new ideas that sound a new note of maturity in Orwell's post-Spanish political writing. There are still occasional shrill propagandist passages during World War II, in parentheses, and this is a quote, "Either we turn this war into a revolutionary war, or we lose it." And that comes from the collected essays of Orwell. Then also, let's see, we have, "And the penchant for exaggeration," again in parentheses, and a quote, "I dare say that the London gutters will have to run with blood. All right, let them if it is necessary," the end of a quote. But there is also an increasing tendency to transform political feelings into critical political ideas. The 22 pages of Emmanuel Goldstein's "The Theory and Practice of Oligarchical Collectivism" in 1984 are to the point, indeed. Here are the old feelings of Blair about the exploitation of the poor, about the subservience of the lower classes to the bureaucratically supported, quote, "they," and about the lying of the press in Spain pass into a carefully thought-out theory. Animal Farm is no way as sophisticated as 1984 in its explication of the structure of the totalitarian state, but political theory is still present. Ironically, it reaffirms Orwell's belief that his change in society structure alone does not of itself constitute a moral advance. Expression of this idea in his later works revealed the perennial conflict between the revolutionary and the moralist, between the yogi and the commissar, between the individual and the group, and it reflects the tension between the pessimistic Orwell, who believed that on balance life is suffering and only the very young or the very foolish imagine otherwise, and the hopeful Orwell who, in his imaginary interview with Swift, was confident that individuals and society can change for the better and that life is worth living. Finally, there was the uneasy balance between the two viewpoints that Orwell thought were always tenable. First, how can you change people until you have changed the shape of their society? And second, what is the good of altering the shape of society before you improved the nature of human beings? Orwell's concern is that no matter what viewpoint rulers adopt, it is no guarantee that they can solve the central problem of revolution, indeed of life, namely the abuse of power. So long as rulers fail to confine violence to the least amount necessary for civilized life, even the best intentions will be quickly corrupted into injustice. As a consequence, a wedge is driven between rulers and ruled, separating them farther rather than uniting them in a common cause for a better society in which everyone would treat others as equals. This problem had worried the policeman Blair into a guilt-ridden resignation from the imperial service, and finally it obsesses Orwell the writer. The problem, of course, remains unsolved in Orwell's works as it does in the world. But out of his obsession came Animal Farm in 1984, the two novels by Orwell that best examine not only the evil consequences of the tyrannical abuse of power, but also the rationalization of it by those in power and the often willing acceptance of such abuse by the very people who are its victims. On the Aragon front in Spain, Orwell had experienced a sense of brotherhood that had filled him with optimism. Also in Spain, this time in the streets of Barcelona, he had seen and felt the nightmare world of ceaseless arrests and prowling hordes of police. As a result, both the kind of life he wanted and the kind he feared were recorded in Homage to Catalonia. In Animal Farm in 1984, the detailed abuse of power whereby the kind of life he feared is investigated. For Orwell, the least evil form of government is the democratic socialism of the early pages of Animal Farm, and that was quickly overthrown. The greatest evil is the oligarchical collectivism of the early pages of 1984, and that might not be overthrown. Above all, the last novel is both the culmination, the expansion of the theme first sounded in Burmese days. This is the pessimism born of Orwell's realization that while there are good reasons to form associations of men in the interests of brotherhood, for people, for example, to mitigate their physical and spiritual poverty and even to safeguard and expand their freedom, such associations are depressingly vulnerable to attack by those who crave power. Orwell's pessimism was progressively exacerbated by the recognition that in any collectivity, the attempt to be rid of the individual self-interest for the good of the group is apt to excite a call to be rid of the individual. It is the individual's right to say what he or she thinks, even when it conflicts with the views of the collectivity that Orwell consistently defends. Quite apart from the climate of the Cold War, which accelerated the initial sales of 1984, it is our instant recognition of Winston Smith as an individual pitted against bureaucracy that gives the novel such a strange intimacy and urgency. Though the year of the novel is 1984, we are confronted by the present. A manifestation of this tension between the individual and the group, one that also reflects the old tug of war between Orwell's pessimism and optimism, is his vacillating views of the Proles and Winston Smith. The Proles, like Faulkner's heroes in their capacity to endure tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow, symbolize the quietism of Henry Miller's ordinary man's acceptance of robbing reality of its terrors by simply submitting to it. Woo! They are inside the whale and live on. Winston Smith breaks out, but dies. To choose between the Proles' endurance, which stems more from acceptance of the world than from bravery, and Smith's brave determination to rebel is one of the central dilemmas of Orwell's work on totalitarianism. That the dilemma looms so large in his final work is due to the fact that Orwell was better at diagnosing what he saw as evil than at prescribing against it. This limitation is plainly evident even in Burmese days, in which, for all his hostility to the exploitation effected by the Raj, no constructive alternative is suggested. Next, for all he tells us of the symptoms of poverty and unemployment in England, the confusion between equality and equal opportunity undermines his all-too-brief formula for social reform in Britain. Then, despite his exuberance in reporting about the Spanish Revolution, which he hoped would help set the pattern for expanding exploitation, for ending exploitation in England and indeed elsewhere, there is the same lack of analysis of how the details of the Spanish experience, the collectives and such, can be adapted for English use. In his final novel, Orwell's turning away from the oligarchical collectivism, while not a rejection of the ideals of the collectivist vision, is devoid of a plan for improvement. Even though he believes that some kind of efficient and centralized state is necessary if the socialist vision is to be achieved, there is only a watery hope that the Proles, as a kind of unconscious but political home guard, will someday mobilize. All across the bleak landscape of Airstrip 1, there is no armory in sight, no hint of a scaffolding for future action, but only the dark certainty of the four towering ministries that form the concrete forts of Orwell's pessimism. The notion held by some that Orwell turned away from his socialist belief, though unconvincing, is understandable when one remembers how, after Winston Smith's total defeat, there is no firm counterattack, not even a slightly theoretical equivalent of the 22-page theory and practice of oligarchical collectivism, no theory and practice for a democratic socialist collectivism. The absence of any such counterattack from his socialist position helps us to understand how Orwell's position amid his contemporaries as to the left's loyal opposition, and in parentheses it says the left hated him, is so misunderstood outside England. It helps explain, too, I think, how in this period of the Cold War, Orwell is often hailed, especially in the United States, as a champion of the right, and how a news vendor once, quote, thrust a copy of 1984 into the hands of Isaac Deutscher in New York, saying, "You must read it, sir, then you will know why we must drop the atom bomb on the Bolshies." This incident is interesting because while it exemplifies a common misconception about Orwell, it nevertheless reveals a basic truth about all his writings, that he is a better social critic than he is a political thinker. Although we always know unequivocally what he is against, we are never as certain about what he was for. The very criticism he leveled against the bourgeois baiters of the bourgeoisie. We'll hold it there because we're coming down to the last pages of this book entitled Orwell, The Road to Airstrip 1 by Ian Slater. So I'm going to hold that out a little bit longer, if you will, just for another part. Plus, there's a lot in there. I don't know if you feel like you want to go back and read it again, listen to it again, or if you want me to read any parts in particular again, which I just feel is leaning to do, but I'll do that on my own time, I assume, and try to distill some of those down, perhaps for the next time. Or even if we do what might turn out to be a part, shall we say, 10, which would sum things up. Maybe if you feel like positing some comments via email, if we can get enough of those from you folks, we get a nice spectrum about how everybody feels. And if we get, I guess, so much of a spectrum or any kind of polarization to one thing or the other, I guess we somewhat fall into the same trap that Slater writes about. We know what he's against, we don't know what he's for, and also the riddle may continue as to what Orwell intended 1984 to be. I'm just thinking, I'm not going to waste your time. But listen, thanks very much for listening to this part. We will go through a part 9 that will finish the book up and this very wonderful chapter 11. And we'll see you next time. You know, thanks for being with us.
This program is produced by Visigoth Incorporated. Any rebroadcast or use of this program without the express consent of Visigoth Incorporated is strictly encouraged. I'm Phil McCracken, the voice behind the voice, and thank you for listening.